Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 257th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, which is now but one of four podcasts that comprise the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, the others being It Happened in Hollywood, Behind the Screen, and TV's Top 5. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and this episode is presented by Walt Disney Pictures' Mary Poppins Returns, which is nominated for four Golden Globe Awards, including Best Actress in a Musical or Comedy, Emily Blunt, Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Best Picture Musical or Comedy. Mary Poppins Returns, for your consideration. My guest today is an actor who just turned 22, but already has starred in four films that were nominated for the Best Picture Oscar. 2014's The Grand Budapest Hotel, 2016's Manchester by the Sea, and 2017's Lady Bird, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And he also starred in three of the most acclaimed films of 2018. He played a key supporting part in actor-director Jonah Hill's skateboard world dramedy Mid-90s, and he was the male lead in actor-director Joel Edgerton's gay conversion therapy drama Boy Erased, for which he has been nominated for a Best Actor in a Drama Golden Globe Award, and in Ben Is Back, a drama about a young man grappling with addiction, which was written and directed by his Oscar-nominated father, Peter. I'm talking, of course, about Lucas Hedges. Hedges first won widespread notice for his work alongside Casey Affleck in Manchester by the Sea, which was written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan. Affleck and Lonergan won Oscars for their contributions to the film, and as for Hedges, in addition to being nominated for the Best Supporting Actor SAG, Critics' Choice, Spirit, and Gotham Awards, and for the Best Breakthrough Performer BAFTA Award, and winning the Best Breakthrough Performer National Board of Review Award and the Critics' Choice Award for Best Young Performer, he was nominated for the Best Supporting Actor Oscar, becoming the first actor aged 25 or under to receive an acting Oscar nomination since Brokeback Mountain's Jake Gyllenhaal 11 years earlier, and simultaneously joining Dev Patel as the first male acting nominees who were born in the 1990s. Ever since, Hedges has been one of the most in-demand actors out there, not only for films, but also for theater. Indeed, he was nominated for the Best Actor in a Play Lucille Lortel Award for his work in the 2017 off-Broadway production of Yen, and he is now starring on Broadway, opposite the legendary Elaine May, in a widely acclaimed revival of Lonergan's play, The Waverly Gallery. Over the course of our conversation at the Westin New York at Times Square, shortly before a Saturday matinee of The Waverly Gallery, Hedges and I discussed all of the above, plus much more, including what it was like growing up in a family of artists, why he constantly battles self-doubt about his own artistry, how he came to be championed by the super producer Scott Rudin, and why it is that he has so often wound up working with actor-directors. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Lucas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living? You have maybe a more interesting answer than others.
Yeah, well, I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. My mother was an actress, a theater actress, actually, for a long time. And my dad was tried to be an actor, then became a playwright, and then became a novelist, and then became a filmmaker.
Yes. And when you say that, somebody might jump to the assumption like, oh, okay, you know, somebody's parent is in the profession, that's how they got in. In fact, I just want to take immediately right off the bat, establish, yes, your film first film appearance was in your dad's film, Dan in Real Life.
Yeah.
But that's not really, that's not like that was the beginning, because there were another 5 years before you really got into this. So can you explain how this actually started?
Yeah, well, my dad, I grew up going on to my dad's sets, and I've always felt like the most magical thing in the world for me was film, was the idea of it. And like, he was always showing me movies, and so it seemed like a dream. And the people who I was always most amazed by were actors, but it didn't, I don't know, in actuality, I never, even though it was so real, like before my eyes, I never actually thought about doing it.
Yeah.
Until I did all the school plays, and then a casting director saw me in one of them, and I ended up auditioning for Moonrise Kingdom.
Yes.
And then I got that, and then I was like, I want to be all over IMDb. I was like, that was, I just remember, like, it's so funny because I'm wearing a turtleneck right now, but I remember thinking, all I want is to have like a photo with me and a group of people at Sundance where I wear a turtle, like a wintry looking turtleneck, and like we look like we're friends in like some sort of like booth of some kind.
And that's happened.
And it's happened. And No, but it's just interesting that at the beginning of my career, and still at times today, I can't shake like this idea of it, but I just wanted to be a part of that world. It wasn't even the artistry of it.
Right.
It was like, I just wanted to be seen with the cool kids, you know?
Well, partly I would imagine because it sounds like from things I've read, just in the home growing up, you would have all these actors and people coming in and out who, was it just, you got the sense that this is the kind of vibe I'd like to have in my life, or I like that they are the way that they're kind of seen by others. How would you pinpoint the appeal?
I would say that I'm a kid, like I think most kids who grew up, I spent a lot of my time in my head and my imagination and in fantasies. And the only place I knew of that actually offered like a way for me to not only like I could live in two fantasies at once. I could live in the fantasy world of being an actor, and I could live in the fantasies in the worlds of the movies.
Yes.
So it felt like the biggest win-win in the world. And I always, whenever I saw actors, I just felt like they were either chosen or had claimed lives for themselves that I saw as being like when I saw Super 8, when I was like, that was that movie really made me want to be an actor, because it felt like, not only did I want to be giving those performances, but I just wanted to be in the 80s doing a monster movie, like with like sci-fi.
Right.
It fed a part of me that really never felt satisfied living mm-hmm. in reality.
So just to go backwards for a second, in school plays, I had read that you were actually not totally enjoying yourself. It was, like probably a lot of kids, there were elements of stage fright and other things. So yeah, the idea of acting was cool, but when you were actually doing it, were you enjoying it?
I was always overcome by fear and stage fright, and my favorite moment was always right when I walked off stage. So I don't know what that means. I don't know why I kept seeking it out, but I know that I had some sort of insane amount of fear, and that was really what made it unenjoyable. That having been said, I took sketch comedy or like improv classes when I was in like fifth and sixth grade, and mm-hmm. those were a blast.
Yeah.
That was just pure fun.
I would think in some ways that's more stressful because you have to now come up with your own material.
Yeah. I think it was just, it's all a reflection of the environment I feel I'm in. So if I'm in an environment in which there are zero stakes and it's just like friends messing around, I mean, I don't get nervous, but if my life is on the line, which is for some reason how I feel when I act, I mean, it's how I feel when I act today.
Yeah.
For the viewers out there, me and Scott were talking about Glenda Jackson before
yes.
I came on, and talking about how she won 2 Oscars and then just disappeared. And a part of me was like, wow, like I feel right now so much like a prisoner to the parts of me that just want to be received well by mm-hmm, the world. Mm-hmm. And I really admire the hell out of somebody who can just like leave and live their life. And yeah, I'm constantly dealing with, okay, why am I doing this? You know, what do I want to get out of this?
Interesting. Well, just to give props to the person who we have to thank for you being here today, I guess, who was this casting director and what happened?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's Doug Abel. Well, actually, it wasn't, Doug's the first guy who gave me my first job, and Doug cast Manchester too, actually.
Okay, okay.
But the first movie I ever auditioned for was a movie called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Yeah.
And it came down between me and the boy who got it. And it was like a week long callback period.
But that even itself came about because somebody came and saw you in play.
Yeah.
So who was it?
It was this girl named Romilly in the grade beneath me's mother, who I think used to be a casting director.
It.
And I think because St. Anne, the high school I went to, is like every celebrity in New York sends their kid there. So like if you go to a middle school play,
right.
It's like Maggie Gyllenhaal, Jake Gyllenhaal,
right.
Peter Sarsgaard. Like it's odd. It feels
right.
like an event of some kind.
Did you who was in your class?
Jennifer Connelly, Paul Bettany.
Well, but they're older.
Oh,
they're
as in they're the
they were there. Right, right.
They were the
was
parents.
There anybody? Well, you're a little ahead of the curve. You made it younger than most people. So they're as anybody.
Oh, any other
actor. Yeah, from your year, I mean.
Yeah, the girl in the grave beneath me, Maya Hawke, who's daughter, and she's in Stranger Things and soon to be in a million things.
Yeah.
This kid who's a freshman when I was a senior is a brilliant, brilliant boy named Fred Heschinger,
okay,
who just got one of the leads in the new Joe Wright film, Lady in the Window.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He plays opposite Amy Adams, and I don't know. I think that might be it right now. I'm sure there will be more and more, but from my generation, I think that was
sure. And yeah. That was so the mother of the girl a grade beneath you is the one-time casting director sees you in what?
Nicholas Nickleby. Nicholas Nickleby. It's Mike.
Okay, this is seventh grade.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was, I remember I had this whole monologue about how no one loved me, and I would just sit backstage trying to like think of sad things that would make me cry. And for whatever reason, I was like really good at doing that. Like I was able to make myself cry, and it was like nobody had seen a seventh grader do that in like a play. So it was exciting for the people to be like, oh, there's a little boy and he's crying and he must be good. And I don't mean to say this to congratulate me, because I think that like particular ability has gotten me into trouble as an actor moving forward. The idea that like, oh, you cry, and that means good, like you're good.
Right.
When in reality, it's like, I think it's very dangerous to rely on your emotions. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm talking.
No, it's very interesting. Okay. So from her seeing you.
I was in puppetry class, and I got a call from my mom, or the puppetry teacher was like, your mom's on the line. And I went outside, and the phone was outside the door, and my mom said I had an audition. And so I got really excited, and I went in and auditioned for this casting director, Mele Nagler. Mm-hmm. And I, the next day, heard back. I went in and read with Stephen Daldry, the director.
Or extremely loud and incredibly close. Yeah.
And then the day after that, and then I was thrust into this like week long audition callback process.
Yeah.
I didn't get the part.
Was that crushing? Did you think that was your one shot?
Well, I remember being overcome with fear about it. And then being terrified that I would get it, and then when I didn't get it, like going up to my bathroom and looking in the mirror and just crying. It's like, you ever have, I don't know if you've ever, I don't mean to get too personal, but sometimes in my darkest moments in my childhood, I would cry and look at myself in the mirror. But I met Scott Rudin, who gave me this part in the Waverly Gallery.
Yes.
And who's, I did Lady Bird. And
I was going to say, he's been a big champion.
Mid-90s. And even I did The Corrections, which was an HBO pilot that never got picked up, of Noah Baumbach's.
Yeah.
But it began the longest, most important professional relationship I've had in my career. And Moonrise, he hooked me up with Moonrise.
Well, so before, because, I guess Moonrise Kingdom would be the first thing that did go that you were a part of in movies that where it was beyond that early part as an extra in your dad's movie. But I want to ask you about Rudin, because he's probably the most influential person in film, TV and theater who your average person at home has not heard of.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can explain from now having gotten to know and work with him, just can you pinpoint what makes him so special?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing honestly, it's hard to even describe, but I think with respect to theater, Scott's sort of like a freelance artistic director in that he has an idea. He can get it done. He has all the resources. Nobody doubts him.
Or screws with
nobody's going to doubt him because of his track record.
Right.
I think he has just really great taste and a passion for his work that is simply unparalleled. Like everybody I speak to who works with him says that I watched this interview with Chris Rock that says Scott Rudin. He said, Scott Rudin got me to function at a rate that I'd never thought was possible. He pushed me to a place that I didn't think was possible. And it's because he really lives for what he does.
Yeah.
And he surrounds himself by people who feel the same. And when those people come together, it's really a crucible for, I guess, really great art. I don't know.
So when he was at that audition for Extremely Loud, you didn't get it, but did he make a point of saying to you, look, I really...
Yeah, well, he then like hooked me up with a bunch of theater tickets and sort of... I really felt like he took me under his wing in a way and was like, whenever I came in and auditioned with him, he was there and was so supportive. And even like one time he... let me sit in on a business meeting of his that he was in development for some project. Mm-hmm. And I got to sit in and just listen to them riff creatively. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like whenever he was working on something and there was a part for me, he was very generous. Mm-hmm. and was really, like, believed in me.
Yeah.
And to have his support at that age, I was like, I don't know, I really felt like I was something.
And so that age would have been, let's do the math, you were born in which year again?
96.
96, and Moonrise came out in 2012.
But so that we filmed that in 2010 even.
So you were like 14, 15?
I was.
And now, for the first time, having a semi-substantial part in a movie, like something to do, yeah, as opposed to a small bit part, what was that experience like? Because I think people sometimes forget that screen acting is such a different beast than theater acting, I think. I don't know. Maybe you don't feel that way.
Yeah, I think what was tricky about the first few projects for me is I really got really scared on camera, and I started to feel like what's dangerous about fantasies is that when they don't go as I want them to go, mm-hmm, they become kind of nightmares, mm-hmm, in a way. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like with film that I was so excited to get these projects, and then that I was somehow disappointing the people I was working with. And then it was like, it was as if I'd been given access to, like, go to Hogwarts, but all the people that I dreamed of getting to spend my time with wanted nothing to do with me.
Which in your mind.
In my mind, exactly. Yeah. It wasn't like Wes Anderson was like, get out of here, kid. Like, I'll never, like, what are you doing? Like, I really wasn't treated that way. But like, right, I said, you know, I grew up a lot of my time in my head. So most of this stuff I experience in isolation. But what happened is I kept having that experience, and which is what sent me back into the theater, because I felt like, if you're ever going to figure out how to act, it's going to be there.
Right. But you're talking like in the last 2 years coming back to the,
yeah,
theater.
But I did. I went to this theater program. That was what sent me to this theater program when, okay, I was a junior in high school, which is what sent me to college for theater.
Yes.
And then I was just like, I need to study. I need to actually figure this out. I can't just like show up on set and like hope my like life turns into a fairy tale, you know?
Well, so yeah. So I guess that would have somewhat overlapped that theater program and maybe the beginning of college with the first, maybe it didn't overlap with the first few films. First Wes Anderson, Moonrise Kingdom, then Jason Reitman, Labor Day, then Wes Anderson again, Grand Budapest Hotel. But that was all probably before you were done even with high school, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did Manchester when I was a senior in
still
high school.
Still in high school? Yeah, oh, so. My gosh. Okay. But wait, so it wasn't a confidence booster for you to know that whatever you did in Moonrise Kingdom was enough for Wes Anderson to invite you back?
That was definitely a confidence, okay, booster. And to this day, makes me really happy that he feels like I belong in that world. Mm-hmm. Makes me really happy.
So you went off to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. You're saying the main driving reason was to hone your theater,
yeah,
acting.
Yeah, I just wanted to feel like when the opportunity came again, if I got another opportunity to like be in a project I really cared about, that I would just crush. I just wanted to crush it.
Yeah.
I wanted to be like, yes. And the other reason was I felt like I could experience the kind of playfulness that I experienced in those early like comedy classes. That, yeah, if I went, so it was a mixture of, I want to actually reconnect to the effortlessness that I have experienced before and work on some kind of craft.
So what was it that made you decide after 1 year that you're out of there?
Well, it didn't go as I had hoped. The teachers were very hard on me, and rightfully so. I found myself really despairing a lot. God, I really know how to like paint the portrait of my life. So much despair. And it was confusing because Manchester came out halfway through the year, which is in the very middle of my biggest sort of feeling of, wow, okay, all these teachers are right. I really don't know what I'm doing. And then the world all told me otherwise.
Right. That must
and
be
I was,
confusing.
It was really confusing. Right. And I felt like I couldn't trust the world. And I gave school another shot, and I really was planning on going back. But then Greta was at Sundance and saw Manchester, and I had a meeting with her during my spring break, her freshman year, and she told me I could be in Lady Bird. And I was going to do Lady Bird during the summer, but then it got pushed. And I just couldn't miss up on the opportunity to be in that movie. It was just like, Saoirse Ronan occupied that again, going back to this sort of like otherworldly feeling.
Yeah.
Like when I saw Lovely Bones or really any movie of hers growing up, it was like, who is that girl?
Right.
And then to get to go to high, be in high school with her and be her temporary boyfriend. It's just too, it was like, I couldn't miss out on that.
Right.
So
right.
I decided not to go back to school. And then I've been working since.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump backwards for a minute though, because the big breakout thing obviously was Manchester by the Sea, but it could have been Interstellar.
Oh, well, oh my God. I mean, I suppose it could have been, but I don't think I was on their radar at all.
Well,
like, I auditioned.
You auditioned for which part?
Tape. I think it was like, I don't think it could have been any part other than Timothy's part,
right.
But I don't.
And did you two know each other at that
no.
point?
Well, what's really funny is that I remember once I was going to do a reading of a Jonathan Demme movie. And I was really excited about it. But then when I read the script, the character had to sing. And I was like, I'm not doing this. And I backed out.
Right.
And then it was early enough in my career that I was like, I still wanted to know who was doing it. And I was friends with the casting director who set it up. And he was like, oh, it's this amazing actor. Nobody really knows who he is yet, but Timothy Chalamet. And I was like 14 or something.
What was the movie?
And it was the beginning. It never ended up happening.
Okay.
But it was the beginning of my understanding of the,
of him, yeah.
Timothy.
And just to remind people, so he ends up getting the part that you read for Interstellar, which was this McConaughey's son.
Yeah.
But you then beat him out for Manchester.
Finally, right.
And then you both wind up in Lady Bird. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But
opposite ends of the coin.
Yes.
Timothy is not to be stopped, I think, from this point on. I really want to get an opportunity to act with
him. I was going to say, we got. I think, though, the internet would crash if you guys did that together. So
I'd really love that.
But let's come to what you said, I think, was your senior year of high school when you did Manchester. What led up to that? How did you and Lonergan first meet, and how'd you hear about it?
Well, I just was sent in a breakdown to audition, and I saw Michelle Williams, Casey Affleck, and I was like, boom, like indie, this is going to be cool, indie, hip, like ain't them body saints. Like, I was like, I watched that trailer so many times. I was like, I'm going to be an ain't them body saints. Like, like this is going to be cool.
Right.
I read the script. I loved the script so much. Met with Kenny and it went well.
Well, was that intimidating, though? I mean, this guy is considered one of the great.
I didn't know who he was.
But I heard a fun fact.
Oh, but I'd met him when I was like a child, because like I was a baby, apparently.
Through dad, writer.
Yeah, through my dad.
Yeah.
And he knew my dad. And there's actually a really great photo of my dad and Kenny at the premiere for my dad's movie, Pieces of April.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
I met him, and I mean, I knew This Is Our Youth. I hadn't seen any of his movies. And we had one audition, and he brought me back. We did another. It sort of got better and better. And again, Doug Abel's casting, who's my guy. And we ended up doing like the third audition or fourth audition, I think, was with Casey.
Okay.
And I was just so excited about that.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So excited.
Ain't Somebody Saints.
Yeah. And I just thought I killed it too. I was like, I'm getting this part. And then I didn't hear from them for like a month. And then I found out they wanted me to do one more, and they took me out to the production offices, and I met with the cast, and I read with them all. And then on the way home, Kenny was on the same train back, and he seemed to be avoiding me. So I was like, oh man, I don't think this is going to work.
Right.
Then he told me on the train that I got it.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Man, it was a great moment. And we went on to make Ain't Them Body Saints.
Yes.
Sure enough.
Another sequel.
Yeah.
The reboot.
Did he ever tell you why he decided to go with you?
Yeah, he did. It wasn't because, I mean, I think it's very different. The character's very different on the page than me, but he told me that he chose the person who he would like to spend the most time with in a cinematic way. Like,
yeah.
I don't think he was like,
we're gonna hang out.
Yeah. But he was like, who would I most want to see in this movie? And it was me.
So even though, as you've said, not a ton of resemblance physically between you and Casey.
No, the character. Oh yeah, definitely not.
Right.
And the character, I think, is more of a working class, like North Shore, like fisherman kid, you know, who plays hockey. But you know, Kenny comes from the theater, and I don't think he's not like Andrea Arnold. He's not gonna like go out and find some person on like the street and be like, you're the lead of my next movie. Like, He really believes in actors.
Right.
So.
What, once you got working with him, were you able to figure out kind of makes him different from other people? Because I guess it starts with the writing, but then also I guess as a director, his process is kind of unusual. So yeah. Especially though with the writing, because you've now, we can preview what we're going to eventually come to, but you're now back with him with yeah. on Broadway in the Waverly Gallery.
I'm back, baby.
Back.
I'm back.
That's another return invite. That's got to be another confidence booster. But writing and directing, what makes him different?
Part of the reason why I think we were such a perfect fit for Manchester is I was an actor who really didn't know what I was doing. And he resembled more of an acting coach to mm-hmm. me than a director when we were making that movie. And that when I'm in acting class and I do a scene and the teacher stops me and says, okay, let's start again, but focus on this or try to get this. Mm-hmm. They phrase it in terms that are playable. You know, it's not, okay, can you do it again, but be a little more angry or be a little more sad, which is what you get with most directors. Mm-hmm. Kenny only spoke in terms of things that I could do or get. Or I remember one time we were doing a scene and it was like a night shoot and it was like 4 a.m. and I was exhausted and he kept trying to get me to really, like, he wanted it to really be clear that I cared about this. It was the scene where I'm just really fighting to not move. Like, I don't want to move away from it. I don't want to go live with him. And at one point he was just like, okay, what do you care about? And I was like, I said some things and he was like, okay, that's what the scene's about. It was really revolutionary for me because it was like, wow, okay. It doesn't matter what it is. I just have to fight for something.
Right.
And he really just wanted to bring that out of me.
Well, you said there was another scene, I think, that on the page was maybe the most daunting, but when you actually went to do it, actually turned out not to be, and that's where your character essentially has a panic attack.
Yeah, the freeze.
How did you guys get through that?
He gave me some, he even started like doing the scene before we started, and he was like, okay. And then he opened the freezer and started breathing really heavily, and he was like, whoa, like I just... He was like, see, even then I'm summoning a lot of emotion. And I was like, wow, Kenny, that's really cool. Good for you. Now I have to do it. I was anticipated it a lot, and we did a bunch of takes, and it was getting there slowly but surely. And then we ran out of time, and I was like really disappointed. And then Casey was like, you guys have to give him more time. They gave us more time. And what happened was I was like kind of experimented with just like not speaking with anyone the whole day. Mm-hmm. And then it really caused a lot of turmoil in me and it all came out.
Yeah. That's a great scene. Yeah. You know, it's obviously a very dark story that the film centers on, but you, in some ways, part of what made it such a pleasure to, when you were on screen, is that even though your character is also dealing with plenty of shit, there's sort of this element of comic relief that we're not getting elsewhere, right?
Yeah. And it was very interesting because at the time, I even when we were making the movie, I wasn't aware of how funny it was or how funny the character was written.
Right.
Because dry humor is not a part of my upbringing. It's something, and the character is just dry as hell. He's so dry.
Right.
But I was even like really confused it's just Kenny's brilliance. Yeah. Oh my God. He's so brilliant. But when we were watching Manchester, it was like all these laughs.
Yes.
I was like, where are they coming
from?
This
is at Sundance, first time seeing
Sundance,
it?
Yeah, Sundance,
So before Sundance, though, even, when you're watching Casey in particular work, a guy who's, what, maybe 15 years older or something like that, who started young as well and giving what would end up being an Oscar-winning performance— was there a major takeaway from seeing how he worked that you were able to, what impressed you the most, even if you didn't end up kind of incorporating it into your own process?
I think the thing that makes Casey so mesmerizing is how little he cares about, what I struggle with is having the right take on things. And Casey's sort of just like, sometimes I see him in a movie and I'm like, when I watched a ghost story, I was like, at times I was like, is he about to fall asleep? But like I say, the reason why I think that's amazing is because to be an actor and to be able to be so loose and relaxed and so almost able to like drift away it's mesmerizing to watch, because I typically I see so many actors who are just like they're so aware that they're being watched, and Casey's not one of those people. So a lot of what I learned from him, I think, was just seeing like some, it was just like being able to witness something right. that I'd never seen before.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about, you finished Manchester and just a few different things happened at that point. First of all, just on a lighter note, is it true that you asked the actress who played your girlfriend?
Oh, to prom?
To prom?
Yeah. Yeah, I did ask her. I mean, it was sort of like, yeah, I did.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
I did. Well, she was like 23 or 24 at the time, or 22. I don't know. She was older than me.
Right.
And then I think she said yes, and then she talked to her friends, and they were like, that's really weird. And then she told me, and I was like, I remember telling Kenny, I was like, yeah, she couldn't come to prom with me. And then when she arrived on set, Kenny was like, why'd you say you couldn't go to prom with him? You just told him you could go to prom with him.
He made it awkward.
Yeah, and I was like, Kenny, are you kidding? But Kenny,
okay, so that was still during the production. It wasn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Well, I give you credit for going for it. That takes balls.
Kenny.
All right. So now movie, I don't know how long it was in post-production, but ends up at Sundance, where it is a huge thing and gets acquired, I think, there by Amazon for a lot of money, and that put a spotlight on it.
Yeah.
And then there's this long wait till the fall when they're going to release it.
Oh, yeah. And I honestly didn't even then I was like, I remember Kevin Walsh, our producer, being like, the Amazon's going to buy it for this much money. Awards campaign, awards campaign, awards campaign. And even then I was like, I don't know what that is.
Right.
Like, I had cut off in a way from what I thought was, like, I was like, none of that is real.
And or you felt it would affect you, because I read you thought you were the thing that was going to kill the movie.
Oh, yeah, I definitely thought that. Well, I saw the movie by myself in a screening room, and I was like, I was very down on myself. And then when I saw it at Toronto months later, yeah. I was like, maybe I did. I was like, whoa, I was like, I did a good job. And then I saw it at New York Film Festival. I was like, I was terrible.
Well, you had plenty of festivals to reconsider. Yeah.
And then that was the last time I saw it. It honestly was a really slow burn. It was like the slowest burn of my life.
Yeah.
What it took for that movie to come out, and then for it to slowly, like, that awards season was crazy, man.
Well, can we talk about, like, what it's like for the first time as a young actor to be in the middle of that, just what it involves? Because I know I was part of the grind of it from your point of view. I was one of the, I did Q&As with you guys where I was my other people, you know, there's things like this podcast, there's a million things. And I guess people might assume that it's all just kind of fun to be the focus of attention and having to answer a million questions and whatever, but it's a months long thing. You can't often get involved with other things because you have to wait and see what is happening here. Yeah. I know you did work it out that you could go do off Broadway with Yen.
Yeah.
I think during that.
Yeah.
But just how did you experience that as the momentum was building for the film and the attention started to come on you? Because I think with the exception of the folks at the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, I think every other group nominated you for their award.
It's a very overwhelming time. It was also incredibly exciting. Like, other than the, like, intense anticipation, which is probably the most unpleasant aspect of it, like, there's just way too much dangling before my face that I was like, just give me.
Right.
I was like, give me all of it. Like, that was dangerous to see that part of me and how badly I wanted to be validated in that way, especially because I'd felt so unvalidated at school. So I wanted this sort of like stamp, like I wanted like a tattooed on my body.
Right. Where you could kind of essentially be a middle finger to your teachers.
Like, check me out. Like, but it was also like a moment of time that I was like, again, like I was living a fan. It was like, this is, I was truly then like brought into the fantasy realm. And I was like, it was, again, to use the Harry Potter analogy, it was like, we're going to tap three bricks.
Yeah.
We're going to like, this wall is going to disappear and we're going to be in like Diagon Alley. And it felt like at times like the fantasy was coming true. And I was meeting all these people I grew up with, the faces, and they liked me. And it was like that. It was so overwhelming.
Your dad had been through it when he was nominated for, was it About a Boy he was nominated for? I think.
Yeah.
So that would maybe like 14 years earlier.
Yeah.
And you were throughout this Manchester period, still living at home, right?
Yeah.
So were you able to compare notes at all? Get any? Was he able to give any advice? I mean, it's also different for writers because they're not the face of
it. It is different. I think the only moment of connection we had was like, whoa, that's like two generations in a row.
And yeah.
I think it just felt like when we were watching the announcements or whatever. Or I wasn't watching them. My mom was, and then when I found out, I went and watched with her. And there was like Jason Reitman appeared and was like talking about him and his father, and I was like, whoa, this is a cool tradition.
You're talking about the morning they announced the Oscar nominations.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But the trickiness of being nominated does not lie in, like, it's amazing to be nominated and to feel that good. The trickiness for me was, like, a year later, even though I was in all those movies that got nominated, I was
Lady
like,
Bird,
there's
three
a part
billboards.
Of me that was like, I don't know, it's just dangerous getting that level of validation.
Because you have
like,
to really, always
then
chase
I'm just
it.
Like, I don't even know. The standard of what a good year looks like is insane.
Right.
It's like, look at Sam Rockwell, who like worked 40 years or 30 or 20, however many years to get to where he is. Like that's the kind of path I want.
Yeah,
in my darker moments, I wonder like what being nominated really like gives me in terms of a long-term growth.
Well, just for that, one last thing about that Manchester era and the awards thing. That Oscar night, you go there, you're nominated. I'm trying to remember.
I won. I end up winning.
Who did win again?
Mahershala.
Oh, yeah, Mahershala, right.
I remember for a moment, though, I was like, I think I won. Like right before she was like, and the Oscar goes to, or whatever. And I was like, oh, my God, I won.
At least you didn't start to get out of your seat.
I
mean, people have done that.
It wasn't like that. I wasn't like, I won. Right. It wasn't like... I was just like, for a split second, I was like, holy shit. Like, which like I knew wouldn't happen.
What made you think? You just thought...
No, I think it was just like, it's like, I don't know if like you ever like the lottery gets read. And
right.
It's like...
The first few numbers.
I don't even know. It's just like there was a split second where I was like, it could happen. And then I was like, maybe it happened.
So Mahershala wins there, but Casey and Kenny won.
Yeah.
You see them both win.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And then the end of the night, Envelope Gate.
Oh, my God.
You had a great seat
insane.
For history. So
what?
All right, so just because I love talking about
please.
How did you experience that? What did you think was happening?
Well, I just saw they were giving their speeches, and then I saw, I think in the background, I saw like somebody like walk really quickly across the stage, and I was like, what's going on? And then everyone was talking in the audience and was like, oh, no. I think maybe my mom said they didn't win or something. And I was like, no way. But a part of me was like this is unreal.
Right.
Like,
right.
I felt like I had, front row seats to like a really like now it was a piece of theater.
Right.
Like it was like before it was this like show.
Right.
I don't even know what it was. Like all of a sudden everything became so real.
Right.
It was exhilarating, man. I was like...
I was there, but I didn't have as great a seat as you. That was crazy.
That was insane.
Yeah.
I think I have a photo, actually, on my other phone.
Yes.
Of all the Moonlight actors walking down the aisle, and Ashton Sanders with his hand over his head, hands over his head, and Trevante is like, it's so cool.
I feel like that, in some ways, is going to be the thing that's remembered longer than anything else about that night. I mean, it certainly is.
Really cool. Yeah.
Anyway. All right. So let's just... go through the following year, which is the year between Manchester and the current year, where you had both Lady Bird and Three Billboards. So, first of all, you said Lady Bird was first, right? That
yeah,
came first.
Well, no, actually, I filmed Three Billboards
before
Lady Bird.
Okay.
I filmed Three Billboards at the very beginning of my summer of freshman year, so it didn't jeopardize my ability to go back. And
got
then
it.
Lady Bird... I had to choose.
And Three Billboards, you're playing Frances McDormand's son.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's a nice little streak of, you can argue,
kids,
you're
right?
the, well, but playing the person opposite somebody who wins an Oscar for their work with you. So I think you can claim a chunk of credit for Casey and Frances. But so there was that one where you're basically just, you know, the pissed off son of a woman who's grieving also, right?
Yeah.
And from her, my sense is she's a pretty unconventional actress as well.
And somebody who really, like, over the course of her career has trafficked in like claiming her own independence, which is, again, like, a lot of the people I idolize most in this world are the people who are like really punk in that way. You know, I have a kind of my own personal fascination with the Marilyn Mansons of the world, the people who go on talk shows and look like present themselves as the very opposite mm-hmm. of what society would champion. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who really wants to be the most liked person, like mm-hmm. I can't even begin to tell you what it means to see somebody like that. Or mm-hmm. I want to think about like people like Tim and Eric, these guys.
Yeah, comedy guys.
When they went and promoted their movie at Sundance, they do the most, or when they've even been on like more like Good Morning, like Austin.
Yeah.
The way they promote their movie is so brilliant to me because they're not there to accommodate anyone other than themselves. And it's not like selfish. It's right. just, so.
Frances, just that she doesn't give a shit.
She falls in line with those people, you know? And she also is somebody who went to school, trained to act, and I was really lost when we were filming, and she helped me. And
how'd she help you?
She helped me, again, put it into terms of like, okay, this isn't about emotion. It's about, she even studied under the teacher that my teacher at school was teaching the method of. So we were doing the Gister method.
Okay.
And when I brought it up to her, she was like, oh, you call it the Gister method? When I was at school, we just called it Earl's class.
That's cool.
So I was like, word. Yeah. Like, I'm doing Earl's class with Frances. Like, yeah, so that was really great to work with her.
And then you go into Lady Bird, where it's Greta's directorial debut. You said she knew you from seeing Manchester at Sundance. I guess, is it true that the way it was presented to you was like, you can pick either of these two young men, either the one that you played or the one that Timothy ended up playing.
Yeah.
So why'd you pick
Probably the
one
last you
played?
Time I'll have that opportunity over Timothy. I felt like I connected immediately to what I saw on the page, and it felt like shoes that I could really easily fit into. It felt like right in my wheelhouse. Right. And I'm all for the character that's like, ooh, that's not the obvious choice, but it didn't feel like this was the obvious choice I wanted to jump for.
Yep. Is it purely coincidental that so many of the films in which you've appeared were either directed by fellow actors, so Tim Blake Nelson, Anesthesia, Greta with Lady Bird, Joel Edgerton, Boy Erased, Jonah Hill, mid-90s, or in the case of an upcoming movie, Honey Boy, written by a fellow actor, Shia LaBeouf?
I don't know why it's worked out like this.
Just the coincidence, you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm definitely not like just seeking them out, you know? But for whatever reason, this is how it's panning out. Yeah.
And do you feel that, having also worked obviously with non-actor directors, are actor directors able to do things that, you know, help you direct you in a way that others can't? Like, is there an advantage to working with?
Well, that's what really varies person to person, you know? Actors really aren't one, they're like a million different things. I think the advantage an actor-director has over a director is that actor-directors have worked with dozens of directors. Directors only have themselves as references.
Right.
So Greta sort of was like an amalgamation of like, of how she directed was like an amalgamation of like Noah, Mike Mills, like her own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But she just like was able to pick and choose what she liked. Jonah's the same way. And Joel is like really somebody who just loves actors mm-hmm. and gives the actors the free reins. But there were things that he was like, okay, like Jeff Nichols did this for me mm-hmm. and that was really helpful. So I'm going to offer you the mm-hmm. same. So yeah, I really like working with actor directors.
Interesting. All right. So for the home stretch here, let's tackle 2018. It's not even mm-hmm. over, and you've done three films.
Jesus.
And one Broadway production.
Yeah.
Some of them are still, I think, rolling out in parts of the country, right? I don't know that, for instance, mid-90s or Ben Is Back is everywhere yet. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but
I don't. Well, Ben Is Back isn't out, period.
Right.
But mid-90s, is that still expanding?
I'm not positive,
but
I mean,
October again.
Well, Ben Is Back, though. I think for sure there we've got to tee it up for people because I can't assume that they know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So Ben Is Back is you're playing a young man who's been in recovery from heroin addiction for 77 days, returns home on Christmas Eve, ostensibly because he's been told he's well enough to do that,
or he feels he is.
He feels he is, and then we follow him over the course of one day. That's you, and then your mother is played by somebody people may have heard of, Julia Roberts. And the writer and director of this is
my
Peter
dad.
Hedges. Do you know what inspired him to write a film about this topic. I heard Philip Seymour Hoffman was a good friend.
Yeah. Well, there's actually this great, my dad showed me recently this photo of Philip Seymour Hoffman holding my older brother.
Yeah.
When he was like 2.
Right.
But Philip Seymour Hoffman's my dad's favorite actor, and I think that took a toll on him.
Were they were friends, obviously.
Yeah, I think they were friends. I wouldn't go like far. He wouldn't be like, yeah, Philip, my best friend.
Right, you know, right.
If they knew each other.
Right.
But addiction's a very big thing in our family, and my dad's mother struggled a lot with alcoholism. Uh-huh. But there are some people whose lives have been, in our immediate circle, uh-huh. have really been threatened by uh-huh. Drug addiction. So. Yeah. This was a very important story for him, and I didn't think I would want to be a part of it, but when I read the script, he didn't even give it to me to consider. It mm-hmm. was just like, because he knew I wouldn't want to do it.
Why would you not want to do it?
Just the idea of working with my dad seemed way really uncomfortable, and I made it clear to him, he wasn't like, please, can I work right. with you? And I was like, no, Dad, like, leave me alone.
But it would be uncomfortable because, what, you were afraid that people would think this is just nepotism or something?
No, just because it's uncomfortable. It's already uncomfortable enough to, like, have Thanksgiving dinner. Like, making a movie is the most difficult thing in the world. Like, to be doing it with your dad is, like, I don't know. It's just too much. It's too right. much to handle. But that was what I thought before we did it.
Right.
And then the more I entertained it, the more I was like, huh, okay, maybe if I turn some of these thoughts around, there's an opportunity
right.
here. So
I heard Julia Roberts might have tipped the scale to some extent.
Yeah, she definitely didn't hurt my desire of doing it. But
I mean, even from her to your dad, was she saying, what I've heard that she's been saying is that she was leaning on your dad to make sure that you did it.
Yeah, I think she really wanted that to happen. And that was, I was like, sometimes when I don't know, if somebody like makes a decision for me and I'm like, right. I mean, I was going to do the movie, but right. it was like, she really wants me, like, I want to do it.
So how does one who has not been a drug addict oneself, I assume, I believe, prepare to play someone who
yeah.
is that deeply into it?
Well, as you can probably tell from this podcast, I'm very self-involved in my own occasional self-hatred. Like, that's a very big part of my life. And I think that is the common theme between any drug addict or alcoholic of anybody who relies on substances to mm-hmm. self-soothe. That is why. It's mm-hmm. because they don't know how to be with themselves.
Right.
So I feel that that's my thing. For whatever reason, my escape isn't substances. Mm-hmm. It's much more of about being liked and of more of a validation thing. But it's not as much of a stretch simply mm-hmm. because I don't have those. I'm not drawn towards these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to a lot of AA and NA meetings and just tried to understand what his bottoms had looked mm-hmm. like and what recovery really looks like.
How does that work? You get a kind of approval in advance, like, from people that are in recovery,
yeah.
and they
well,
say,
"Well, I have people who are very close to me who are in these programs mm-hmm. and who I went with. I tried not to go to any. I mean, I didn't go to any. I went to only open meetings
because yeah, yeah.
I just felt like I didn't want to be in there and say I was, you know, belonged where I didn't want to lie.
Yeah, yeah.
And they take these things very seriously.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then when I felt like I heard a story that I was like, wow, that feels very similar. I was very transparent with
yeah.
the people I wanted to talk to and said, do you want to have lunch or something?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and that was my way in.
I don't know if you saw this, but my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, this guy, Chris Gardner, who wrote, and so therefore I feel like I can share this with you. He's written openly recently about the fact that he, for, you know, a good number of years after starting out as a pretty successful journalist in Hollywood, then fell into drug issues badly and left the scene for a few years and has worked his way back and is doing great again. But he wrote an article recently saying about, you know, what it's been like for him to see this season of movies in which addicts of one sort or another are portrayed on screen. Ben is Back, Beautiful Boy,
wow.
Star is Born, and others. And one of the things that he said in that article, which I encourage people to read, was about Ben is Back. He said, quote, "The 12-step meeting featured in the film is the most authentic one you'll see," close quote. And I think he's not talking just that you guys got that. I wondered for you whether if it was that scene or another that you felt was sort of the trickiest to pull off.
I mean, I think the biggest stretch for me is the movie goes into a kicks into another gear. And I think it was less a stretch for me to be in that meeting as it was going to sort of the darker places of being a drug dealer is something that I was like, okay, those were the aspects of the film that daunted me more because I don't, it's not as easy for me to just pull off from where I'm at right now. So those were the things that were on my mind. Yeah.
And so as you look back at the whole making of that movie and the fact that you did overcome your hesitation about doing a movie with your dad,
yeah.
just a few things. I think your dad maybe with the Hollywood did a something with the Hollywood Reporter that I read where he was saying one technique that may have been employed was you didn't call him dad during the making of the movie.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't.
So what did you call him?
I called him Pete.
And that was...
called him Pete Hammond.
We're covering all my competitors on this podcast.
No, we were just with him, so...
But what's the rationale? Is
that's a journalist joke, I think.
That is. We got it, yeah.
People, a lot of people are going to be like, what?
Well, Chris Tapley, same. But but the idea there is just for your own sake to create a separation or to send an idea to the other actors and people on set?
I think for everything. I really didn't want people to waste any energy on the fact that I was his son or I am his son. The fact that I used to be his son.
You were Zion.
Yeah. No, I just didn't, you know, I was already, so much of my brain naturally goes there. So I just felt like if I just eliminated that, the more it would just become, resemble any other film set.
And right.
I'd rather go to work in that environment than.
Were you still living at home?
Yeah.
So
but
would
you we filmed it in White Plains, so I was staying in a, we were all staying in a hotel,
okay.
So I wasn't. But we did go home and do Christmas.
Pete, do a lap around the block before you pick me up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or drop me off down the street.
Right.
So nobody sees that I'm entering with you. We did have a break for Christmas in the middle of shooting, and we spent that break together, which was odd, but we made it work.
Right. And then just, I think, because this speaks to your commitment to the craft, why were you not able to be at the Toronto International Film Festival World?
I'm doing a play, the Waverly Gallery, and we hadn't even moved into the theater yet. And I was doing this Trey Edward Schultz movie called Waves, a little too close to comfort before I entered into the Waverly Gallery. So I really, like, my days off were filled with, they were not days off. They were filled with me for trying to catch up, trying to catch up for lost time. I felt like if I went, not only would I miss a day of rehearsal, I would, 2 days would be filled with press. I wouldn't have any time to run lines or work on the script. And I really needed that time. And I wasn't really worried about missing Boy Erased and mid-90s as much as I was Ben Is Back, just because it's my dad and I wanted to be there with him. And he was really supportive. So...
Yeah,
so he really greenlit it all the way.
All right, so Boy Erased, this film about gay conversion therapy, which is something not everyone knows even exists. But it's in dozens of states in America.
Yeah.
Inspired by a memoir directed by and co-starring Joel Edgerton. What was the draw for you to this one?
Well, I loved the book. I really loved Garrett's voice. I felt like the book was a blueprint to his inner world, and I'd never had that access to that much material before. So I thought it would make my job a little easier. And I also felt like, okay, now here's an opportunity to be a part of a story that is in service of something bigger than me. It's not, you know, Manchester, there's all these movies are artistically so valid and are in service of something, but it's so much more obvious this movie's in service of. So it was like, okay, here's an opportunity for me to take it out, to take the pressure off of myself and put it on to what can I serve.
So having prepped by spending some time with Garrett, the guy whose memoir inspired this, and maybe doing other forms of prep, which I'll leave it to you if you want to bring in, I guess my question is, who is the movie for? Is it sort of, who are you guys hoping to reach with this?
Well, it's really not about preaching to the converted. Joel tried to make sort of like an art house film that for middle America in a way that like anybody can see it. And really, he didn't want to alienate anyone. He just wanted to tell a true story about a family trying to make sense of the hand they've been dealt. So I think in an ideal world, in my mind, parents perhaps of children who parents who would want to send their kids to these programs would see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the tough thing is, I doubt you're gonna. I mean, hopefully that's what having like an actor like Russell Crowe or Nicole Kidman does to it is like, you know, maybe the parents who saw Gladiator and were like, hell yeah, I love this guy, we'll go see it. And maybe their minds will be changed, you know?
Have you heard yet from, has it been out long enough for and wide enough for people yet to have seen it and reach out to you to say that it's affected me personally because of things?
I don't have social media, I don't know how they would.
Yeah.
I haven't really heard from people, but I see that as being the reason why. I mean, I go to events and I speak to people there, and I've heard feedback then, but no, I don't have a means of...
Right.
Yeah.
Last thing about Boy Race is, in a recent interview with Vulture, you chose to speak for the first time about your own orientation. And if I just briefly can quote, you said that you find yourself somewhere on a, quote, spectrum, close quote. And the fuller part was, quote, not totally straight, but also not gay and not necessarily bisexual, close quote. What convinced you to share that information at that time as opposed to, say, a year earlier when you're doing Lady Bird, where you're playing a closet guy? And what sort of response have you received to that?
Yeah. I feel like there are moments when it's not really my job as an artist to make it about me. I feel like sometimes I try to just support the material. In this particular instance, I felt like the subject matter was so overtly about what it means to have a certain sexuality or to identify as something that's not like immediately acceptable in the world. And I felt like after having played this part, it didn't seem right for me not to be transparent, you know?
Was it scary to have to get into that?
I mean, it really doesn't feel like the biggest thing either in many ways. I feel like also a lot of what I'm expressing probably is what most people identify with, just haven't been given the opportunity to express themselves in an honest way. I think what's exciting about the direction the world's heading in is that things are less black and white. And I just don't find these sort of very confining terms as being helpful or, I guess, progressive in many ways.
Yeah. Did Joel know already when you were brought into this part? I wondered if it was even something you shared with Joel.
No. Well, I mean, probably actually it wasn't, but it wasn't like, you know, Joel, like, this is true about me. I think it was, what was clear is that I felt like, I feel like I have a very complex relationship with myself, and Joel trusted that we would be able to tell the story. And he's not necessarily one of those directors who's like, let's just like share everything about our lives and work from there. I know those people and I appreciate working with those people, but it wasn't this particular process.
Right. Third of the three movies is...
God,
Jonah Hill's mid-90s. You're playing Ian, the physically abusive older brother of the protagonist, this younger kid who's getting into the skateboard community. I'm trying to think. I mean, I feel like it's your first time playing an asshole.
Moonrise Kingdom, I was a bit like that. But, I mean, that's sort of... It's my first
that's
time
reductive.
Playing an asshole in, like, a world that is, like... Is it's like in like a real... In, like, a hyper-realist... Like, Wes Anderson's world is more of a... stylized, like, it doesn't necessarily exactly resemble reality.
Right.
So this is more like that.
And did you have to figure out in your own mind, why is this guy so angry and mean to the younger brother? And how do you, as an actor, convey that without being kind of one note?
Yeah, that's definitely what was thinking about. I think whenever I look to a dynamic that I don't feel like I immediately understand, I turn to my relationship with myself because I don't outwardly treat people like that. Mm-hmm. That having been said, that doesn't say anything about what actually goes on in my head. And I think this whole idea that, like, if you're not mean to people, then you're not a mean person, or that suddenly you're a good person is actually kind of bullshit. Like, I know a lot of really amazing people who are not really trustworthy at all. And I think what I saw as the opportunity here was to, like, express a part of myself that really doesn't get the time of day or I don't allow to be voiced out of fear of being a mean person.
Right. Waverly Gallery, you're back. Well, this is first time on Broadway, which is an amazing thing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Saw it Wednesday at the matinee. It's a very powerful thing. And just to give a little, I'm trying to do a log line of it for people who may be coming to New York.
How
much longer are you?
We go through January 28th, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a autobiographical thing for
Kenny. It's true. Pretty much true story.
And you're essentially playing Kenny as a young man, where his grandmother, who's played by Elaine May, who's amazing, 86 years old, hadn't done Broadway in 50 plus years, comes back and is playing a woman who's, I guess, descending into, would we say, dementia or Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer's.
And we talked about the fact that it's a compliment to be asked back by Kenny at all, something that has also happened with your co-star, Michael Cera, who's
third time.
I've seen the others with This Is Our Youth and Lobby Hero recently. But from each of those co-stars, I guess, somebody who's been doing it for as long as Elaine May has, and then somebody who has been in the Kenny program for as long as Michael has, what have you been able to take away from that?
I'm sort of in the camp right now that, like, I can't really take that much from observation. I'm sort of like, why I like theater is that I get to just do it again and again and again from me. You know, it's what I do take from being with them is that I genuinely love our company. Mm-hmm. We just really get along. Like, for example, the other day, we created a playlist of all of our 10 favorite songs, and it's in, like, we have 50 songs where that's just like sort of like a little microcosm of the heart of the show in a way.
Do you remember what Elaine's favorite song is?
Yeah. Well, she's oddly, one of her favorites is this song called, you know, Sweet Dreams by the Eurythmics. It was like when I asked her one day during rehearsal what her favorite song was, and she was like, I really like this song. It's like, I didn't expect you to say that.
Amy Lennox,
But yeah, she also loves Hit the Road, Jack, Your Smiling Face, James Taylor. It's a really great, great list.
But I guess, do you look at her and say, I can see myself at age 86 still doing this?
I honestly can't say I see what she does as being humanly possible in my experience. I don't know how she does it.
8 times a week.
I've never seen her do the same thing twice either, which is insane. Mm-hmm. Insane. I mean, it's the most unfathomable part on paper. And she's like truly effortlessly bringing it to life.
And you're enjoying it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I love doing it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. And
thank
congrats.
You for
it's
having
been
me,
fun.
Man.
Really,
I really appreciate you. I appreciate you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that. And would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.